We'd like to ask that you stick around to the end of this episode to hear a promo for our friend Jess Carter's podcast, Outlines. Jess has an incredible gift, a storytelling style that is elegant and pulls you in, allowing your mind to see with seemingly crystal clear perception the locations, events, and people she describes. I can't put into words how perfectly brilliant Outlines is. Go check it out. If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. There are several varying donation levels to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels and Patreon-exclusive episodes available at most levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. You can interact with Gone Cold Podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching Gone Cold Podcast. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I think the whole problem with the Patterson's case is that from the very beginning, the investigation was botched. And so time was lost. It took several months for the disappearance report to be filed. The relatives weren't notified right away, and the whole thing was handled very, very strangely.
It has been more than 61 years since the disappearance of Margaret and William Patterson. Law enforcement were not involved in the vanishing of the couple during the first days, or months for that matter, so it is almost certain that evidence, witnesses, and crucial leads were lost before an investigation even began. Police shouldn't be considered at fault for this particular fact, though, as the Pattersons wouldn't be reported missing until 5 months after they were last seen. It might be argued, however, that police failed in their investigative efforts by never asking for interviews from several individuals who were friends and associates of the couple. The papers even scrambled at that point to dig up leads and exclusives, often providing information that couldn't be confirmed in time to make the deadline, and may or may not have been confirmed or corrected later. Diane Washington Valdez, a former reporter for the El Paso Times, who has done extensive research into the Patterson case in recent years, summed up for us why this made the case so unnecessarily complicated and convoluted, but helped secure its place as one of El Paso's most speculated on mysteries.
I think that things developed over time, and you're right, things are, I think it's easier to write about crimes this day and age. We have people with cell phones and cameras in their cell phones. We have video cameras everywhere. It's more difficult to hide events, especially public places, in the streets, that sort of thing. And it's also easier to transmit information quicker. And we know from the internet that we also can transmit misinformation much quicker than before. I think that people back then were just doing the best they could with the information they were given and the information they obtained. And the case itself kind of lent itself to this air of mystery. And so people started filling in the mystery with all sorts of rumors and wild theories.
Because any of the known scraps of information could be considered potentially vital or at least pertinent to the disappearance of the Pattersons, no matter how seemingly insignificant, things may seem a little overwhelming for the next several minutes. Margaret and William Patterson were last reported seen on March 5, 1957, when they stopped by the Ward Motor Clinic that afternoon to ask the owner, Cecil Ward, to diagnose and repair the air cooler at their home. Cecil Ward was told the next day by D.G. Kirkland, an associate of the Pattersons, that the couple had abruptly left for vacation at an undisclosed location. Others who sought to contact the Pattersons for both friendly or business purposes were told the same. And though the impulsive vacations seemed a little strange, everyone assumed that nothing was amiss, as the couple often took holidays without necessarily informing others they were doing so. A telegram was sent on March 15th, 10 days after the Pattersons were last seen. It was received by Patterson's accountant, Herbert Roth, and it instructed him to rent out their home for at least 9 months, and D.G. Prince, owner of a local janitorial company, was employed to get the house ready to be leased. Attorney David J. Smith, who often handled affairs for William and Margaret, said the telegram was no fake, as it contained specific knowledge that only he and William were privy to. William, according to Smith, had talked about wanting to incorporate his business with himself as lead and subsequently retire to Mexico for at least 3 years, though William had done little to see that transition through. When friends or patrons of the Pattersons inquired as to where the couple was, employees insisted that the couple was on vacation in Florida or at a convention in Washington, D.C. The Pattersons were indeed scheduled to attend such an event in D.C. Longtime friends of the Pattersons who lived in Jackson, Michigan, but whose names are unknown, were expecting to see the couple at a photography convention in Washington, D.C. at an unspecified time in March, the month the couple vanished, but they never showed up, called, or canceled. He said that this was not like them at all. He'd personally made the reservations for the Pattersons at the Statler Hotel. Of course, the telegram from March 15th gave instructions specifically to Art Moreno to cancel the reservations in D.C. Art Moreno was a young employee who worked at Patterson's Photo Supply for 7 years by 1957 and, by all indications, was something of an apprentice to William, who was teaching him how to run the business as the store's manager. On April 1st, 1957, the Pattersons' close friend and owner of the Ward Motor Clinic, Cecil Ward, called Patterson's Photo Supply to ask what he should do with the Pattersons' vehicle, as it was repaired and had been there for weeks. A Patterson Photo Supply shop employee subsequently came and picked up the car. The next several months saw nothing but quiet speculation by those in the community as to the truth behind the Pattersons' whereabouts. Their departure was abrupt, but since the police weren't involved and the couple often traveled, overt concern was non-existent on the surface. Neighbors, though, were skeptical that the couple simply left on vacation when Margaret's adored cat, Tommy, reappeared hungry and sickly. They continued to feed the feline, who was left, for whatever reason, to fend for himself. Mr. and Mrs. Ray Thompson of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, were owners of the Thompson Boat Company and close friends with the Pattersons. They'd sold William the boat he'd been working on with Cecil's help. Mr. Thompson noted that William still owed him for the boat and that the Pattersons were also expected to have attended a boat show with he and Mrs. Thompson on May 1st, 1957. But May 1st came and went. When they didn't show up, Thompson called Patterson Photo Supply several times and was finally told by employee Art Moreno that the Pattersons were on an extended vacation. Back in El Paso, D.G. Kirkland, an associate of Williams who managed the Duffy's Photo Service in El Paso since it opened in 1955, began buying stock in Duffy's Photo Service with the intention to take over the business entirely. Duffy Sasser, owner of Duffy's Photo Service, allowed employees to buy stock in his company. Kirkland owned 10-12% of the business and was beginning negotiations with a partner to buy the entirety of Duffy's. Kirkland oversaw Patterson Photo Supply for about a month, then returned to his home in Lubbock, where he became president of Duffy's Photo Service there. He'd made trips to Patterson Photo every few weeks, checking on the business end, but after July never returned. During this time, Kirkland suggested that Herbert Roth, William and Margaret's accountant, work some for Duffy's. Roth did, and ended up buying 8-9 shares of that company. In July of 1957, just 4 months after the Pattersons vanished, a British couple, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Belson, his wife, and their children moved into the Patterson home. Their move-out date was scheduled as December 15th of that year, or 9 months from when the telegram was received that gave instructions to rent out the house. The Belsons had been feeding a stray cat on and off, but because the animal had bitten one of his children, Lieutenant Colonel Belson brought the cat to the DLKD Animal Hospital on September 3rd. The cat was instantly recognized by Dr. Katie as Tommy, and upon inspecting the feline and realizing his condition, was sure something was amiss. Apparently, Dr. Katie was unaware at this point that Tommy had reemerged. The beloved and usually pampered feline would usually be kenneled and well taken care of when the Pattersons left town, and the pet's malnourishment and abandonment raised a red flag. Margaret would not leave her precious Tommy under these conditions. Everyone knew that. Tommy stayed at the animal hospital. Later, and bizarrely, considering his access to the Pattersons' money, accountant Herbert Roth would deny that the cat was Tommy and refused to pay Dr. Cady the bill for his boarding. Both Dr. Cady and William Patterson's father, Luther, both identified Tommy. Word around town began to spread that there was more to the couple's absence than what had been simply explained as an extended vacation. A few weeks prior, and 5 months after the Pattersons were last seen, on August 15, 1957, Cecil Ward filed a missing persons report with the El Paso County Sheriff's Office. Sheriff Jimmy Hicks assigned the tight-lipped deputy, Sheriff John B. Frizzell, to attempt to locate William and Margaret. Frizzell commented to reporters in the El Paso Herald Post that it was the most baffling case he'd come across in his 17-year career. Investigators learned that D.G. Prince, who had cleaned the Pattersons' residence after the telegram came in, found the house in utter disarray, with unwashed dishes in the sink. Ladies' underwear and a pair of stockings were laid out on the bed as if they were to be worn soon or put away. El Paso County Sheriff's Office investigators were clueless as to what happened to the Pattersons' Cadillac at this point and told the press such, although the telegram presumed to be from William indicated that the cars were to be licensed to the business. Sheriff's Office investigators began collecting information that might lead them to Margaret and William's whereabouts, none of which suggested that the couple had gone on holiday. The Pattersons' trailer home had been sold as per telegram instructions. William and Margaret hadn't withdrawn any unusual amounts of money before their disappearance, and absolutely none after. Some of the Pattersons' expensive items of clothing, including a fur coat, were left at the cleaners, and no instructions as to storage had been given. No utilities at the Patterson residence had been disconnected temporarily or permanently. The newspaper and mail were still scheduled for delivery. Virtually every possession the couple owned had been left behind. Attorney David Smith told the El Paso Herald Post that even if he did know where the Pattersons were, he wouldn't tell the newspaper or Sheriff Hicks under the client confidentiality agreement. The attorney did, however, say he'd been making extensive efforts to locate them. Investigators were able to determine that the telegram was called into Western Union from Dallas Love Field Airport and was paid for in nickels, dimes, and quarters through the payphone used. They were unable to confirm that it was indeed William who'd phoned it in. El Paso County Sheriff's officers searched the couple's basement for recently poured concrete and scoured their backyard for freshly covered holes. The Patterson home sat just below a large desert hill, and reasonably, you'd probably presume that this area was searched thoroughly for recently disturbed earth, but there are no reports of such a search having been performed. Margaret's signature, which used to adorn all company checks, was replaced by Herbert Roth's, the Pattersons' accountant and business manager. Both Roth and Kirkland were reluctant to speak with Deputy Sheriff Frizzell or the press, and when questioned, Roth's go-to response was always, "No comment." William's family was located and informed of the situation. They were concerned, of course. They requested a formal inquest and told police that if Margaret and William did not return, or at least disclose their location, they would continue to push for one. However, after speaking with Roth and Art Moreno, who both put them at ease with the explanation and assurance that William and Margaret were indeed on extended holiday, William's family decided not to move forward with the inquest. They were even reassured that Tommy had been left to the care of neighbors, but no neighbor ever came forward to validate those claims, not to mention the fact that Tommy was always boarded at the animal hospital when the couple traveled. More than a year would go by without a sign of the Pattersons. Margaret Patterson's relatives, maiden name, and even where she was from were still mysteries to everyone, in fact, until after April of 1958, when the badly decomposed body of a woman thought to have been dead approximately 1 year was found in California. El Paso investigators thought they'd got the break they'd been waiting for when they were alerted that the woman's body fit the description of Margaret Patterson. The El Paso Times circulated a photo of Margaret with the story of the body found in California to other papers across the United States via the Associated Press. Her former landlords in Evansville, Indiana, recognized the picture and were able to give information that led to her siblings, who hadn't seen her in over 20 years. One of Margaret's sisters told the press, "We thought she was dead. She'd last seen Margaret in 1937 and last spoken to her in 1940. The body found in California, though, was not Margaret's." In June of that year, the Patterson's attorney, David Smith, received a typewritten letter dated May 29, 1958, signed by hand. The letter read,
"Dear Dave, I want you to handle this matter for us. We will not be back to El Paso, and by the time you get this, we will be out of the country and nobody can find us. We want Art, Doyle, and Herb to each have 1/4 of the business. The other 1/4 must be divided equal among the other employees at the store. See that Art gets the house and furniture. Doyle is to get the cabin, tools, boats, and the Cadillac. Keep the VW for the business as well as the lots. I expect you to be fairly paid for all the trouble. Margaret wants her account to go to the CYO. Art Moreno, Doyle Riley, and Herb Roth should make a good trio to run the store from now on. Yours truly, W.D. Patterson."
Since the details on the letter are specific, and there is actual knowledge of assets and the photo supplies personnel, it was written by someone familiar with the Patterson's interests. Handwriting experts were unable to determine, with accuracy, if the signature matched William Patterson's penmanship when compared. Investigators for the El Paso County Sheriff's Office found it odd, though, that no assets were allocated to any of William's many living relatives. Neither the envelope nor the letter provided a return address. The letter, along with what investigators found or perhaps didn't find, prompted members of William's family to finally and officially request a court of inquiry. Mrs. Katie Wall, Margaret's sister who was alerted to the Patterson's disappearance when the body in California was found, came to El Paso. She was distraught about her sister, having thought twice at this point that she was dead, and sought to see what she could do, to see if there was any chance that she could pressure the courts and law enforcement to proceed more diligently and aggressively in pursuing the whereabouts of her sister. She conferred with Sheriff Hicks and District Attorney Clayton and rounded up her brothers and sisters, who joined the request for a court of inquiry. On June 2, 1958, the inquiry got underway. Kirkland testified that he received a call from a person claiming to be William at 3 a.m. on March 6, 1957, and that the caller told him that he and Margaret were leaving for a long vacation. Kirkland, half asleep, he claimed, asserted that the man, who he says he assumed was William, wanted him to have use of his prized Cadillac while they were away. He said he was almost certain that the voice was indeed William Patterson's. At the time, Kirkland was a resident of El Paso. He told the court that the evening before the couple was last seen, on March 4, 1957, he, Cecil Ward, and William all gathered in the Patterson's garage to work on William's boat, which they'd all planned to do the next night as well. Cecil became ill, though, so plans for the 5th were canceled, and Kirkland did not visit the Patterson home that night, he stated. Kirkland took over the store after the Pattersons went away for a salary of $800 a month, the equivalent of about $7,100 a month today, as he was instructed by William via the telegram received March 5, 1957. Luther Patterson, William's father, told the court, "I always knew William and Margaret would take off like this someday. They're not dead. My boy has done things like this before." He said that William had the free-spirited heart of a Kearney. "Pat will come back when he's ready," he added, perhaps unable or unwilling to admit any other notion. There was and is no shortage of theories as to what happened to Margaret and William Patterson. Early theories, largely due to the testimony that William's father provided at the Court of Inquiry, included that Margaret and William simply abandoned their lives for a fresh start. Some of the testimony that D.G. Kirkland gave seemed to veer investigators' theories in this direction as well. Numerous sightings of the couple were called in, too. Some reported seeing them in Mexico and some in the U.S. Though officials at the El Paso County Sheriff's Office were unable to confirm any of these, the sightings fueled possibilities that the couple just wanted to start over. However, the lack of possessions and money taken before or after the Pattersons vanished seems to suggest that this theory isn't particularly plausible. Police also thought early on that the Pattersons were victims of a kidnapping, but since no ransom demand was ever made, that theory fizzled out. As the Cold War raged, and McCarthyism fear-mongering perpetuated a nationwide paranoia of communist spies and sympathizers living practically everywhere among unsuspecting Americans, ready to strike at any given moment to infiltrate every vestige of freedom and liberty that U.S. citizens know and love, the Red Scare inevitably crept into the Patterson mystery. Espionage became a theory that was deemed valid by at least one investigating officer. In 2009, El Paso County Sheriff Leo Samaniego told the El Paso Times that he thought this theory was valid. The El Paso Times would later ask the FBI whether or not the two were ever suspected of being Red spies. Diane Washington Valdez told us what she knew about this inquiry.
They were contacted about whether they had any information on if the Pattersons had been involved in espionage. And at the time they said they didn't have any such information. One of the suspicions was that the couple was involved in spying. And this is because Mr. Patterson was seen often taking pictures of military, Fort Bliss, an important military installation here. That's how that suspicion developed on the part of law enforcement, sheriff's office. But again, there was no proof of that. That doesn't mean that didn't happen, but it's a blind lead.
Some theories even crossed the borderline into absurdity, such as speculation that Margaret and William were the victims of an alien abduction. Urban legends tell tales of the Pattersons being killed in their home and buried on their property, their ghosts still haunting the home at 3000 Piedmont to this day. Whatever the theory, there seemed to be no evidence, no witnesses, nothing at all that would point investigators in the right direction. Or was there? Some leads that were known to detectives relatively early on in the investigation seemed to go ignored. Did police dismiss potentially pertinent information, dooming the investigation from the beginning?
I think the whole problem with the Patterson's case is that from the very beginning, the investigation was botched. And so time was lost. It took several months for the disappearance report to be filed. Evidence was lost or destroyed. The relatives weren't notified right away. And the whole thing was handled very, very strangely. And this is something that I wonder why the police back then, once they started to see that, hey, there's something else going on here, get all over it. While the witnesses were all still around, while the events were still fresh, you know. I believe that after all the investigating that I've done over the years, off and on, that they were probably murdered.
We know the Pattersons just didn't simply cease to exist. There are, of course, more plausible theories than the ones we just discussed. Theories grounded more firmly in reality that actually do consider much of the evidence and events you've just heard, as well as witness testimony and facts about the couple that you haven't. That's next time on Gone Cold Podcast. Have any information about the disappearance of William and Margaret Patterson, please contact the El Paso County Sheriff's Department at 915-538-2292. We would like to thank Richard O. Jones from the True Crime Historian podcast for contributing his time and voice to this episode. You can find True Crime Historian wherever you listen to podcasts. We highly recommend it. We would like to thank Diane Washington Valdez, author, journalist, and president of the DigiZone Network in El Paso, Texas. Mrs. Washington Valdez published The Killing Fields, Harvest of Women, an investigative book that exposed the Mexican killing fields that claimed the lives of hundreds of women at the Juarez-Mexico border. Her work inspired a documentary film, as well as a Hollywood movie. We are in awe of Miss Washington Valdez's work and strongly recommend y'all check it out. The El Paso Times and the El Paso Herald Post were used as source material for this episode. Please stay tuned for a promo from the amazing podcast, Outlines. And if you're interested in all things true crime, you need to go and check out thetruecrimefiles.com. There you'll find well-presented cases, many unknown or ignored by the media, as well as book reviews, podcast reviews, and guest posts. TheTrueCrimeFiles.com is an amazing resource for learning about cases you might not be aware of otherwise. Check it out. It's one of our favorites. Thanks for listening, y'all.
This is the Outlines Podcast. I'm Jess Carter. And each season, I uncover unsolved murders and disappearances in a different county of the United Kingdom. I visit the locations of little-known crimes and collate all the evidence, build up a picture of the victim and the times in which they lived and died. If you want to join me, you can find Outlines on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'll map out all the facts, and together, we can try to keep these cold cases alive.